The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
2 days before the national championship game, as Michigan and Washington square off, both teams met with the media in the always eagerly anticipated media day, and who is on their way to the draft. This is the College Game Day podcast. We're recording on Saturday, January 6th. 2 days before the national championship game in Houston. Rhys Davis and Pete Thamel here. So, Pete, we both went over to media days this morning, got a chance to visit with various players, some of the coaches and so forth, even held our own impromptu versions of press conferences where we were asked questions. So a lot of fun was had by all this morning. I think there are a few topics that were worth following up on. Number one is the health of Washington running back Dylan Johnson as they get set to take on Michigan. Any other injuries? What type of things were you able to ascertain that you can share at this early juncture?
Sure. I did a story for ESPN.com on Dylan Johnson's injury, Rhys. Learned a little bit about it. I guess the lead is Dylan said he's ready to rock and roll. He obviously had that significant injury at the end of Sugar Bowl. The last image we have of him is a golf cart going off the field. Now, he said he bruised his left knee and then re-aggravated a lingering right foot issue that he's been battling since their Oregon State game on November 18th. So he expects to play. He said he doubts he's going to be 100%, but the notion from the staff was kind of like, well, he hasn't really been 100% for a couple weeks here. So, And this is just part of the deal. I asked Kalen DeBoer if they expect to have him for the full complement of plays. And he said, as of now, yes. But did leave in for interpretation. If he looks like he's struggling, if he's a step slow, they may adjust as they go on. So generally, if you're a Washington fan, good news, Dylan Johnson's playing, and good news that he's been limited in practice, but has been doing some conditioning and kind of staying in shape. And he's gonna give it a go on Monday night, but no promises. I mean, look, the second half of the season, he was one of the best tailbacks in all college football, period. And so we will likely not get that highest end version of him. They expect to see a pretty good version of Dylan Johnson.
Well, that would be fortunate for the Huskies if that's true. Now, they throw the ball about 60% of the time anyway, and there's still been continued wondering about just what the situation was in terms of not only illness, but whether Michael Penix was at full health, and he certainly is now. You could ask Texas, and they can validate that he is the picture of health right now. So even if Dylan Johnson is not 100%, then I don't think that this becomes a major issue for the Washington offense. It is nice to have him and to have some balance. But doesn't, in my mind anyway, Pete, this game really comes down to almost the same thing the Texas game came down to. Can they protect? Because Michigan gets pressure at a very high rate. About 44% of the time, they get pressure on the passer. Now, Texas won some matchups, but Penix did an extraordinary job in the pocket of still being able to create just a little more space, not full-on scramble, just enough of a movement to give himself time to deliver the ball. And he will be far and away more adept at navigating that and getting rid of the football than Jalen Milroe was for Alabama against Michigan. So that almost leads me to wonder how Michigan will adjust its defensive game plan, knowing that Washington might have to throw the ball a little bit, even a little bit more than they normally do if Dylan Johnson is not ready, and with the idea that while a lot of stuff will carry over and they're still going to do what they do, they're not going to change their whole defensive scheme in 1 week, but they can't count on some of the things to disrupt Michael Penix that maybe they counted on to disrupt the Alabama offense.
Yes. So my favorite conversation for media day, Rhys, was with Troy Fa'utanu, the lumbering, big, athletic. Lumbering is probably not the right term because that would indicate he's slow. He is an agile, versatile, large man. And I was alerted by an NFL scout at some point this season to look at Fa'utanu's thighs. They are sequoia trunks, Rhys. They are as large as anything I've ever seen. So, being the serious reporter that I am, I asked him at media day. I said, Troy, do you have difficulty buying pants? And his, and you never know how a big guy like that's going to take that question, right? Because he could be like, hey, buzz off, loser. I don't want to talk about pants with you. And he was great. He lit up. He goes, actually, I don't have many pants because they don't fit. It's been a problem my whole life. He's like, I just kind of wear shorts, even when it's cold.
So, if it gets really cold, he can go with the compression leggings underneath, right there, if he really gets a chill. But it seems to me that he's such a big man, the cold might be afraid of him to begin with.
Yes. If there's two things, if we have listeners who maybe haven't seen Washington much or maybe only saw him in the Sugar Bowl, that there's two things that I remember going to the practice at Washington the Thursday we were there for game day recently that just jumped out at me. One was the size of Fautano and his thighs and how he moves for that big of a guy. That's a fun thing to watch. Like NFL fans who are maybe interloping in to like do draft check and stuff. The other is just, and I can't get over this, Reese, the way the ball leaves Michael Penix's hand is maybe unlike any quarterback that I've had. Now, we'll have a lot of time to discuss hand size, right? That's one of the favorite pet draft things. Michael Penix has massive hands. And if you have massive hands, it's much easier to manipulate the ball, throw a tighter spiral. I would just encourage our listeners to watch him spray the ball. It explodes out of his hand as violently as any quarterback that I've covered.
You know, that it, speaking of turning loose of the football and making it go and the you know, really spinning it, as they say. Jesse Palmer, our friend, is one of the great amateur impressionists of our time, especially of his colleagues. And so when Bob Davey was with us calling games back in the day, I've forgotten who the quarterback was. Heck, it might have been. It might have even been Matt Ryan at Boston College. But at any rate, whoever it was, Bob was calling a game. And they had a tight shot of the pass, and Bob said, "Look at the revolutions on that ball now," and that became a staple of the Jesse Palmer repertoire for a while. So I would wager that when Michael throws for scouts, and when if people. All of our folks who listen to this podcast have seen a great deal of Michael Penix this year, but if they are casual fans who have not, who happen to have dropped into the pod now, between now and draft day, whenever his name is called, I think there are going to be a lot of people going, look at the revolutions on that one. Now. he throws a pretty ball. You know, I asked AJ Barner, the Michigan tight end who was at Indiana this year.
Yeah, sure.
I said, and he was he didn't, you know, nice as he could be, happy to talk about the experiences and stuff, but he sort of chuckled because he said, everybody's asking me about Mike. I said, I understand that. I'm just looking for the anecdote. I said, what's the best ball Mike Penix ever threw you? I said, practice, game, anywhere, best ball. And he said, I don't know. He said, pretty much all the over routes. He goes, but he did shake his head. He said, his deep ball, he just has a knack. He said, he just puts it in the right spot on the deep ball. So it's fun to, you know, to see these guys. So much of the transfer portal talk is negative, but you know, there are guys who move around. They know each other from previous stops or whatever. And it's kind of interesting. Those two guys certainly know a great deal of each other, and you will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure too that Washington receiver Giles Jackson, didn't he start his career? He's a backup. But didn't he start his career at Michigan? I believe he did, if I'm not mistaken.
Started at Michigan. Yeah, he's from Antioch, California.
I thought he did.
I'm glad you brought him up because I think one of my takeaways from Media Day on Washington, and this wasn't, I guess, a new notion to me, but it was sort of detailed by Ryan Grubb, the very sharp offensive coordinator from Washington, who will be a household head coach here very soon, I have a feeling. It was almost like Washington had two seasons, Reese. They kind of had the early flush where they threw the ball around the lot, and McMillan was healthy the first three games. He goes out in Michigan State. The offense sort of drags a little bit, right? And then they have to start leaning on Johnson a little bit and find a new identity. And it's the early high-flying identity combines with the Joe Moore winning offensive line, Dylan Johnson more rugged identity. And now at the end, you have a more balanced team that can win multiple ways. And I really feel like the collision of those two identities is why Washington is here at 14-0. And if maybe they had gone too far into the pass game and not developed that run side, they may not be as far. So I kind of thought that was an interesting perspective on it.
Yeah, we're going to keep saying, I talked to this guy, I talked to that guy, but hopefully that's going to give the people listening some insight, you know, that's not in the formal news conference type thing, but chatting with William Inge, who's the co-defensive coordinator at Washington, and he was talking about how, you know, they hadn't gone really in-depth in preparation, but because there was some anticipation that they would play Michigan in the Rose Bowl, you know, prior to Alabama upsetting Georgia, they thought that was how it was going to fall. So there had been a little bit of, peaking, at least a little bit, to see what it was going to be like to get started. And then they, you know, as things started unfolding, they started getting the call and said, oh, boys, we're going to change gears here. But, I thought that was interesting, too. And I would imagine the same is true for Michigan, you know, that they anticipated for before they thought they were playing Florida State, they probably thought for a little while they were playing Washington in the Rose Bowl. And then as it turns out, they wait and they get here in the championship game. You know, I thought both teams seemed really relaxed, which they often do. I always enjoy the joking around and the guys who end up either taking their phones or someone gives them a camera or microphone and they run around and ask their teammates questions. Some of the Michigan guys were trying to, you know, mess with Will Johnson up there, and Will was like giving serious answers as if you and I had him, you know, under the bright spotlights for College Game Day or something. And I said, you know, are you always this serious? And he goes, no, I was messing with them by being so serious to their answers. So, you know, it was a fun morning. And you know, I don't know.
Did you reveal your man crush on Will Johnson to Will Johnson, Reese?
I mean, he
could be your Drake May man crush for 24.
He could be. I did tell him, you know, I just congratulated him on a great season. Yeah. Talked to him a little bit about what he watches for individually when he's looking on tape. And I said, I know you guys play, you know, a lot of different coverages and different things. But if you got to pick, what would you do? I mean, and he said, well, I'm a press man guy. I said, okay, I know that. I'm asking, who would you like to do it against? He sort of, you know, he chuckled. Yeah. I mean, he's looking forward to the match against all those guys, but I think probably particularly Odunze, given the reputation.
Sure.
So, so that'll be fun.
I wonder, Reese, they didn't move him much this year. And then in the Ohio State game, they moved him with Harrison. Now, there was a drop-off from Harrison to Igbuka, who was never really healthy this year. Maybe less of a drop-off from Odunze to McMillan.
And I agree.
Had an unbelievable game. So I wonder, that'll be an interesting cat-and-mouse strategy X and O thing to watch early in that game. If you see Odunze go in motion and you see Will Johnson follow him, that will be a good insight into, you know, how much Michigan values stopping Odunze. And Marvin Harrison Jr. had a good game against Michigan. He didn't dominate him. Marvin did catch a couple balls downfield on Will. But I do think it was a wrinkle that surprised the Ohio State staff early, because I remember seeing them come back to the bench. We were watching the game from the sideline and kind of not expecting that and having to adjust to it. And that's part of when you'd have wrinkles like that. If people aren't expecting it, it can take a series or two to really adjust to it.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
You come into this and Washington's the underdog again. And they're really, you know, they sort of fed off of it and they thrive. you start looking at the numbers, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's missed tackles, yards given up on first down, which they haven't been great on, which does not seem to be a good formula. You know, dealing with Michigan, although oddly Michigan hasn't been great on third and short, been a little bit better on third and long for some reason. But
that is weird. I saw those numbers. That struck me. Yeah,
it's a weird thing. I think it sort of plays into the idea that their offensive line is still really, really good, one of the better ones in the country, but probably not as overwhelming as it was at times last year. So maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe it's just one of those quirky things that happens from time to time when you start breaking down stats. But you kind of keep falling in the same place, Pete, is, you know, will Washington stand up? And it's not that they're not tough, and it's they're tired of hearing about it. The man who's coming for our jobs in the next few years is Zion Tupuola-Fatui. You know,
yes.
Sort of delightful guy to talk to, but noticeably
one of the great stories of the season.
Yeah, it was, but noticeably bristles when, you know, underdog talk. Can you stop the run? You physical enough to stand in there? The one thing that strikes me about this team, and Inge talked about this a little bit, overall, their stats may not say that this is a dominant defense. In fact, they don't. In fact, it says in many ways that this defense has a lot of vulnerabilities. But what they've done is make plays when they have to. They've sent messages when they've had to. I really think not just of the end of the Oregon game, but the beginning of the Oregon game. When you went into this, Ducks near 10-point favorite in the second match, I mean, and you're ready to see if they're going to run Bucky Irving and run over them because, you know, they'd sort of made their bones being physical. Mm-hmm. And Washington absolutely knocked the slobber out of them on the first few hits. You know, and now Oregon didn't flinch. I'm not suggesting that for one second. They delivered. They gave as well as they got. But Washington delivered the message, it seemed like, oh, you think we're not physical? Oh, yeah. How about this? And I suspect you're going to see a little bit of that on Monday night from Washington against Michigan.
Yes. I asked Fautanu a little bit. I said it seemed like you bristled at the perception that you weren't going to be able to hang in there on Texas. I was like, if you sensed less skepticism this week. And he kind of chuckled. He said, yeah, believe it or not, a little bit less. Now, he's very complimentary to Michigan. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And I think interior-wise, these are the best two teams in college football that they're seeing in back-to-back weeks. I don't think there's a better interior than Murphy, Sweat, et cetera. And Michigan really has three first-round pick-type bodies there in Jenkins, in Grant, and obviously Mason Graham, who I think made the biggest play of the Rose Bowl with that TFL that put Bama behind the chains in overtime there. So, it's a good point, Reese. I do think there is something about Washington, wherever it may be, where they are. Look, they have the Joe Moore Award winning offensive line, right? Where there's just a sense, maybe it's like league perceptions in the back of our mind, and maybe that's leading to some of this talk where, you know, they can't hang in. My curiosity will be how they hang in on the defensive front. They have good pluggers as D tackles, but they don't kind of have maulers there like they do. But good pluggers can slow down a run game. And I have a coaches and scouts breakdown piece coming out here on Sunday, and the NFL general manager told me this. He said, "I just wonder if Michigan plays keep away on Monday night and just grinds the clock, you know, rolls with Corum, picks up their 6 yards here, 4 yards there, moves the chains, Loveland on third and short, and wins by keeping Penix on the sideline."
That's a great strategy. I think it sort of fits into the Harbaugh motif of football because he would be imposing his will and the will of Michigan on them. And the other thing that Sharon Moore and Michigan's offensive line is smart enough to do is they have what a couple of their offensive linemen that I talked to today referred to as spinoffs, things that look the same. Mm-hmm. And they called to mind the early quick pitch to Corum that was blocked in a way that was very similar to other plays that they had run at Alabama and probably seen on tape. and there's less time to do things like that. But they've got a pretty deep repertoire of scheme in the run game to reach down to continue to put twist on their running game. And if they can do that, and particularly with the issue that I mentioned earlier with Washington on first down, giving up a lot of yards and making it a short field. They give up over 6 yards a play on first down. That ranks 101st in the country. And if you start leaving, on average, Michigan is second and four, that's going to be tough. So they're going to have to be – they'll have to be better than their season average on first down, I think, to be able to get off the field. You know, Inge made one other great point I thought about this. He said, one of the things that happens to them, it'll be interesting to see along your lines if Michigan does just play keep away, is he said because their offense is so dynamic and explosive that the teams that they face, that the Washington defense faces, typically looks a lot, the opposing offense looks a lot different than it has on tape because they're a lot more aggressive, going for it on fourth down a whole lot more, trying to get chunk plays to score because they know Washington's going to score. And so what they sort of adopted is that, you know, because they also know their own offense is going to be aggressive, is that they don't care what happened with the sudden change. He even said in the Sugar Bowl that it looked like the clock was going to run out, but he, you know, kind of went and told his guys, we're going to have to go back out there, you know, and just be ready for it. We're going to have to get another stop on him. You know, what would feel a little bit like a sudden change situation. And so that's, you know, there are a lot of different ways to play defense other than just dominating all the stats. Michigan has done it by dominating all the stats, which they have, and they've done very well. And Washington has done it by complementing their offense and getting key stops when they need to.
Yeah. I think what Michigan thinks of Washington's offense will be revealed via their personnel. Michigan plays 12 personnel, two tight ends, basically 50% of the time, which is third most in the country. Now, they have two elite tight ends. Colson Loveland will be a first-round pick type guy in 2025. And Barner, who you mentioned earlier, the Indiana transfer, is one of Mel Kiper's top 10 tight ends in the draft. So that's a rare pairing there. So they use it. And again, the value of 12 personnel is they can go really, really tight and block, or they can spread you out, and you kind of have to make a decision to go big with them or not. And against Alabama, it was interesting. They only went to 12 personnel 22% of the time. It's about half. And that was basically saying, I asked Chuck Morrell, the other DC for Washington, why do you think they did that? And he basically said, Alabama's got some creatures up front, you know, and they didn't want Bama to go heavy. They wanted to see Bama in nickel because they felt like they could move the ball a little bit better. My hunch is, because Washington, again, very good defensive front, two great defensive ends, and ZTF and Braylon Trice, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the country. He's dominant. He was awesome in that Oregon game. He's really disruptive off that edge. But I don't think they have the same physique archetypes, maybe, that Alabama does. So if Michigan thinks they can push Washington around, we'll see a lot of 12 personnel early.
You know, that's interesting. We talked about that on the podcast and on College Game Day, that the run defense of Alabama, and it just shows what a great job Michigan did in scheming that game, and one would anticipate we'll do so on Monday night, that when Alabama was able to go to heavy personnel, they really didn't have the same rush defense problems that they did in nickel. And that, you know, Michigan did a really good job of keeping them in the personnel that they wanted them to be in. And I agree with you. It'll be really fascinating to see if Sherrone Moore and the Michigan offensive staff can devise something and what they would like to dictate to Washington to have to do. And, you know, that'll probably be apparent in many ways early. You know, Sherrone, a guy that you connected me with in the offseason that we've been able to talk to from time to time over the course of the year, was saying today that, you know, with the injury to Zach Zenter in the Ohio State game, that he had been preaching to the offensive linemen all season, it's going to take 10 of you. And which one of you it is that steps in at what times, I don't know when that'll be, but we've got to have 10, we've got to have depth. And that he felt like a real confidence builder for the shuffled, Zenterless offensive line was scoring on the first play against Ohio State after Zach was hurt. You know, okay, it's one play. Sure. You still have to keep on playing. But they sort of were able to see, okay, we're deep, we're fine, lost our best guy. I think everybody would pretty much acknowledge that. But, you know, we still are capable of playing Michigan-style football and still running the ball despite the fact that their best offensive lineman's out.
So. Yeah, I don't know if any assistant coach this year had a better year than Sherrone Moore. He obviously moonlighted as coach to beat Ohio State, moonlighted as coach in three other games and won. And I felt like the game plan, execution, and play calling against Alabama was a masterclass. Like we talked post-game about Alabama being out-coached. And his ability to create room on the edges, especially on that drive you mentioned where – I think there was a McCarthy run on the outside. There was a Corum little flip run on the onto the edge. They found ways to move the ball against a team that's generally difficult to move the ball against. So he will, you know, he gets the biggest stage in the sport now to try and do that again. It'll be fascinating to see how Michigan decides sort of formationally and such to attempt to move the ball.
Okay, for the second straight week, I'm going to say this. We said it, and it was true. Jalen Milroe didn't play well, but Michigan hadn't seen anyone like him. So now, once again, I'm going to say this. They've seen a receiver, maybe two, comparable to Washington's. They haven't seen an offense like this. So... you mentioned that Michigan might try to play keep away, and you know maybe Washington can't stop them from running. Maybe they keep Penix off the field. What if they don't? What if Washington comes out and jumps on them on an early drive like they did Texas? Maybe they score the first couple of times that they have it. Do you think Michigan can keep up in a high-scoring game against Washington? If the game gets in the realm of where the Sugar Bowl was in the 30s, threatening to get high 30s or even more. Is that Michigan's game, or does Michigan need to play the game at least somewhat closer to the way the Rose Bowl was played?
It's a good question because, you know, we get to talk to all these great coaches and you study the great NFL coaches, and the big Bill Belichick thing is they want you to play left-handed, right? And I think if Michigan is playing catch-up, they're playing left-handed because they would prefer to be efficient and methodical. Michigan's efficiency numbers are off the charts.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous. Like their overall yardage numbers aren't crazy. But when you distill it to efficiency, which really matters, right, like maximizing drives, penalties, plays of zero or negative, they are all like top five in the country and all of those really, really key metrics. So again, if you're trying to score in bunches and if you're pushing the ball down the field, you may lose some of that efficiency that defines you. So I would think if Washington sets the tempo high and starts this thing, you're chasing a rabbit and trying to score a bunch, that would take away some of Michigan's hallmarks, which are, you know, slow and steady winning the race.
So as we've gotten to this point, it's sort of a bonus edition of the podcast. Should we make the pick?
I think we should make the pick, Reese Davis. I think we should make the pick.
Okay. So, and last night, so that we share a little bit of behind the scenes, we went to a sensational steak restaurant in Houston where you and I had gone when the Final Four was here also. So we go back to this place, Steak 48.
Monster place.
Yeah, terrific service, great restaurant, great vibe in there. We paid off our bet to Stanford Steve. We thought we weren't going to for a minute. Steve got a little tangled up in the labyrinth that is Houston traffic, but he got there, he made it and got a steak. And, you know, so it's been, we've paid off our bet, but there's one more game to pick. National championship game. Think about this. Michigan and you know you're going to hear this on Game Day Monday. For all of the wins, 1,003 wins. Part of the Michigan legacy is coming up short on the biggest stage. They've got a share of a championship since 97. I said this, you know, when they for some reason sat us up on microphones and had people ask us questions at media day in between the two teams. But, you know, I said, I'm not taking away from 97. Michigan's national champions. They claim it. They should. But so does Nebraska. You know, 91, Washington was national champions. They claim it. They should. But so does Miami. And, you know, Michigan hasn't had an outright national championship out of those 1,003 wins since 1948. Washington's never had one. I think someone said, or I read that Washington claims one in the 60s, but it was not, I think it was 1960, but it was not either major wire service, you know, poll. So, but, you know, somebody awarded them one so they can claim it. It's fine. It's the way the sport was conducted back then. But, you know, hands down, no questions asked. Neither of these teams have an undisputed outright national championship in the modern era. Yeah. I mean, so this is pretty significant for, you know, for your resume and for your perception and for Jim Harbaugh if it's his last ride and all of these things, and for Kalen DeBoer if he becomes, you know, power of the Big Ten and the Pacific Northwest all in one.
Did you see Jim's quote, Reese? Sorry to cut you off.
I did not. No, I did not.
Someone asked him about his future, and he said, "Future, I hope to have one."
I love that.
Something like that. That's a paraphrase more than a quote.
Yeah, there's a calendar. I'll gladly talk about the future next week, and I hope to have one. How about that?
Do you think on Tuesday, if Michigan were to win the game on Monday night, and Jim, first of all, I think he's supposed to do it. Do you think Jim talks about it when he sits down with me on Tuesday morning if they were to win?
You know, that's a good question. One of Jim Harbaugh's great traits is he's an artful dodger, and we got into a little bit of that there. He kind of has this, like, thing where, like, he's, you know, and you can see, like, his mind working. And typically when he does that, it's like you can see the hamster wheel churning to, like, where will I divert this topic to? Like, how will I take what the reporter is looking for and go the other way with it? His quote to do that was, he said he'll gladly talk about it next week. So there's your setup for your quote.
I'll gladly talk
about the future next week, and I hope to have one. How about that? A future. I hope to have one.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So if we're going to make the pick, tell me who you think's going to win the game and what the game turns on.
Good question. I legitimately have very little conviction on this game. I think I'm convicted on we're going to have a great game, Reese. I really feel that way. And I don't really think, like, last year I was pretty convicted Georgia was going to win. I didn't think they'd win the way they did, but I thought if that was three touchdowns, that wouldn't have surprised me. I think that Michigan is going to win, and I'm going to say 34-31. They need their special teams to show up because the special teams were a wire-to-wire no-show in the Rose Bowl, and that's the reason why the game was so close. But assuming the special teams show up, I feel like the game turns with their tight ends. I feel like Washington's personnel is going to be so focused on stopping the run that Loveland and Barner are going to be in for big days. And I don't feel like Michigan's going to chunk them, but I feel like they're going to chip, slow and steady. I had one scout put it to me this way. It's like Michigan just body blow, and then eventually they knock you out. Now, it took the overtime in the Rose Bowl. Hey, we can't root for teams. I can root for overtime, right? Like, I'd love to have an overtime classic here. So would our bosses, by the way. And, but I do feel like we're going to get a great game. So I guess I'm taking the Stanford Steve Hedge, which I always tease him for, where I think it's 4.5 points. So I'm going to say 34-31. Washington covers, Michigan wins.
There is no way I would lay points against this Washington team after everything they've done as an underdog.
Very fair. Very fair.
They think they're, what, under DeBoer, I think they're 11-0 against ranked teams, 5-0 as underdogs straight up. So I think Michigan, I lean to Michigan. I'm like you. Maybe there's some groupthink going on. I hope not. But I'm not convicted that Michigan's going to win the game, but it sort of feels as if I don't believe in the whole team of destiny thing, but I believe in momentum and chemistry and vibes of a team. And they feel like the team that has built to this moment. Not that Washington hasn't, but I mean, over the course of the last three seasons. And here's the opportunity. They're going to have a big turnover. They're still going to be good. They'll still have good players, but there's a big turnover coming for Michigan, whether Jim stays or goes. And it feels as if this is the moment for Michigan. And so I'm going to say that, assuming that they can run the ball effectively on early downs and control the tempo of the game against the Washington defense, that's my key factor. Can they do that? If they do, I say that they're going to, I say they will win the game. I'm going to say 28-27. I'll say 28-27 Michigan, and that stopping Washington a couple of times and making them kick field goals will be enough to get the job done and give Michigan its first outright national championship in the modern era and the first national championship of any kind since before the BCS and the playoffs started, which also is kind of amazing.
Very, very fair pick. And yeah, I really hope this game becomes what we project it to be, right? Like in the fourth quarter, real plays. I mean, so many fun players on both sides of the ball. My appreciation for Mikey Sainstrel has been effusive on this podcast throughout the year. He's a guy who can make a game-changing play for Michigan, and Washington just has a ton of great players both sides of the ball. I'm really fired up to see them play, and then we can watch them play in conference next year, Reese. Maybe we'll be at game day in Seattle for
October 5th in Seattle. I think is the day that they play.
Yeah, I'll say this: game day in Seattle is hard to beat. We're gonna hesitate a second to go back there.
No, not at all. I'll remember to catch the fish with my hands, even if I drop it, in order to protect the suit next time. We're going to hear from Jen Latta in just a second, but I do want to, as promised right off the top of the show, what's the most significant piece of news that you've been able to break on this Saturday morning, or something you are keeping an eye on over the next day or so as it pertains to draft declarations, portal news, coaching news, any of that kind of thing?
Yeah, I would say two things have been front and center. One is Jatavion Sanders, the resplendent Texas tight end, who's a probable first-round pick, told me today he's going to the NFL draft. Not a big surprise, but, you know, as you and I sort of shift to draft season coming up here quick, he's a player we're going to spend a lot of time and energy on. He had, I think, no drops in his last 13 games, 46 catches, 2 touchdowns. He really fits that archetype of the modern NFL, you know, playmaking breakaway tight end. So that was a significant piece of news. And then I think, Reese, there's a lot of focus now on who will Miami get at quarterback. The Hurricanes are still out fishing for a quarterback. Will Cam Ward undeclare for the NFL draft? Still hasn't signed with an agent and take the Hurricanes offer. Is Talia Tungavailoa going to get a waiver? And could he join his brother in the city of Miami or near Miami to have two brothers playing, one for the NFL and one for the college team? Or will one of these other portal quarterbacks pop for the Hurricanes? So I think and then we'll spin it forward. All of a sudden, we could have a lot of change at Michigan, right? I expect J.J. McCarthy to go to the NFL draft. I'm not reporting that he is, but like, mm-hmm. if you look 26-1 as a starter, injury-free his whole time, your whole O-line is gone, your two best receivers are gone, your star tailback's gone. Michigan, again, is going to look a lot different next season. They will still be very good, especially with the young core of defensive tackles, Will Johnson, Loveland. But do you want to take your draft? It's hard to imagine J.J. McCarthy getting hotter than he is right now, mm-hmm. win or lose on Monday night. You know, God willing, he's got to stay healthy. And do you come back and risk a full season with a new O-line and so much change? Whether Jim Harbaugh's there or not would be a factor, right? But I really do think that if Michigan does lose him, that's, you know, they could be all of a sudden in the portal quarterback sweepstakes, right? So does Cam Ward come off the, you know, the draft stump for them? We really can't see anyone else go in the portal.
Until spring, so, right?
Until spring, yes. Now, yeah. Just to give people all the nuances of the rules, players who, like Alabama guys, can go into portal for one more day as we tape here on Saturday. After they lost, same with Texas, obviously. And then these two schools, Michigan and Washington, will get five more days. But there's going to have to be a rapid roster reconstruction for Michigan here, which could be difficult because a majority of the good players have already committed out of the portal. There aren't like a lot of high end guys left. And there's obviously going to be some coaching ambiguity until Harbaugh signs a new deal. And the thing about the NFL cycle that's interesting, Reese, so this game being on Black Monday is sort of a fitting collision, right, of the market of who could hire Jim Harbaugh will be clear by kickoff, basically, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when a college job opens, it's a mad scramble to fill it for all the reasons of recruiting, stability. When NFL jobs open, they could take a few weeks.
Yeah,
remember Harbaugh interviewed with the Vikings on signing day last year. So mm-hmm. It's February. So those two things don't kind of add up. Michigan's going to be very interesting moving forward here the upcoming months, because whether Harbaugh stays or not, they are going to be radically different as a roster. And if he leaves, it will be radically more different. And I guess I'd be remiss to say there's a chance if he leaves that they could target Kalen DeBoer. You know, win or lose, Kalen DeBoer has proven to be one of the elite coaches in college football, period, full stop. So if you're Michigan, and look, we just spent half this podcast talking about how great Sherrone Moore is, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Just a wonderful young coach and a football mind, but he's never been head coach. So
he's got those four. He's got four games.
He does. No, he does. He has four
I'm
games.
I'm kidding. I'm just joking.
Well, yeah. He'll be grateful for those four games.
Yeah.
There's so many different storylines, so many different variables that are going to unspool out of this. So it will be, everyone's like, oh, you're going to take some time off after the season. It's going to remain pretty busy. I got a feeling.
I'm going to offer this disclaimer. You like to laugh at some of the things I like to say, such as two things can be true and that performance does not validate or invalidate selection. Here's another one. Here is another one. Washington fans, just because Pete said that Michigan or somebody else might target your coach, if you remember this one simple precept, your time with me will not have been ill spent. If nobody else wants your coach, sooner or later, you won't want him either. So that's a good thing. I mean, and I think there could be one final thing. This is all speculative, obviously. Jim may say, I'm staying in Ann Arbor forever. But if it were to drag on, say, until the February signing day, I would say that bodes well for Sherrone Moore getting it, because you're going to then put coaches in positions of leaving really good jobs, whether it's, you know, whether it would be a DeBoer or someone else that they might target that's had a good job, leaving good job at an inopportune time that could hamstring their start at the new job, and it might not be the right thing for them. And so I would say that if this were to go on for a little while with Harbaugh pursuing the NFL, if in fact he does that, that might bode well for Sherrone Moore getting the job. But all of this is speculative.
Good point.
As I said, maybe Jim goes, you know what? I'm kind of good here. This is my place and I'm going to stay, and we're going to try to win another one. Maybe he will. I think if I were a betting man, I'd probably lean toward, especially if he wins, knowing his competitive nature, knowing that he came really close to winning a Super Bowl and didn't, especially if he goes to a franchise that is set at the quarterback position, then, you know, that might be something he wants to try. So we'll see. Either way, he's put Michigan back on top, and he will either keep them there himself, or he certainly left a remarkable foundation for whoever the future Michigan coach might be, if Michigan needs a future coach not named Harbaugh. Before we go, one last interview from the Mercedes-Benz ESPN College Football Podcast Sprinter, our very own Jim Latta is going to chat with Maurice Hurst, former Michigan defensive lineman, current Cleveland Brown. Hurst, he ought to have plenty of good perspective on the title game, especially since Michigan's defensive line figures heavily into this matchup. Hope you enjoy the conversation between Jim Latta and Maurice Hurst. This interview is brought to you by the Mercedes-Benz ESPN College Football Podcast Sprinter, coming soon to a game near you, or coming next season to a game near you. Visit mbvans.com/sprinterlabs to learn more.
This is so exciting. This conversation from our custom ESPN College Football Sprinter Van is presented by Mercedes-Benz. And I am joined today by Mo Hurst, who is a former Michigan defensive lineman and currently plays in the NFL. It's a huge weekend, obviously, for Michigan, taking on Washington in the national championship game. What a roller coaster season the Michigan fan base has had. How would you summarize it?
I mean, I think it's everything that Coach Harbaugh really encapsulated, that, you know, this could be the greatest Michigan team that we've ever had. And you saw from the beginning with the suspensions and having different coaches step in and coach games and get that sort of experience, and Moore and all those guys just really keeping the culture. And then you really have to turn to the players and each other. So they did such a great job of doing that this season. It's really impressive. And they're battle tested through that adversity, through those struggles, through the hard times that they had together. I think it really makes this team special. And you can see it on film that, you know, there's something really, really special about this team and what they're doing.
What I love about this podcast is you can hear the environment behind us. Yeah. The Michigan band out there thumping their way through the songs. You were at Michigan when Harbaugh arrived. What's the best way to describe him? He comes across a little quirky, but there's no question he's an exceptional football coach.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think makes Harbaugh so special is he just really loves the game of football. Everything he does is about the game of football. He eats, he breathes, he sleeps football 24/7. You know, he's got a real passion for the game, and you can really see it in every day. And as a player, that really brings you up and really makes you want to put in more work, because you just know how much it matters to him, and it just elevates everyone around him. He expects a lot from the coaches. He expects a lot from the players. Anyone that's in that building, he just expects the best out of him. You know, that just brings everyone together and brings everyone stronger.
And yet he catches a lot of criticism from other fan bases, from other people around the country. How does he handle it? Like, I mean, again, he's always been a little bit different.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really seem to bother him.
I don't think Coach Harbaugh cares what anyone thinks. You know, that's one of the special things about him. It's about us. You know, who's got it better than us? Nobody. Like, that's how he feels. He blocks out the noise. He ignores all the distractions. He really cares about the players. He really cares about the game.
You were there from 2013 to 2017. Give me your best Harbaugh story. I'm putting you on the spot. What's your favorite story when someone talks about Jim Harbaugh that just always pops right into your head?
Oh, shoot. My greatest Harbaugh story was definitely one of our first practices when he got there. We had a running back that is playing for the Bengals right now, Chris Evans. He was in practice, and he wanted to go run a wheel route, but he didn't run it the way that Harbaugh really wanted. So Coach Harbaugh, as you know, you see him on the sideline. He has cleats on every practice. So he gets out there, lines up at running back, runs a wheel route, and pulls both of his hamstrings. And he's just limping the rest of practice, limping through the rest of the game. And then, you know, for the rest of the season, he'd come in the training room, you know, get treatment. You know, he wore the compression shorts that all the guys wear when they have a hamstring strain. And he was just out like the rest of the year. You could tell that there was a little something off about how he was walking or how he was moving around. So I would say that's my greatest Harbaugh story, because it just shows who he is. You see him pregame throwing with JJ or throwing with their quarterback, slapping him on the shoulder. It's like he's in the game. And that's like, you know, that's what I mean when I say he's got a real passion for what he's doing.
Yeah, Father Time catches up with all of us.
All of us.
So, obviously, a huge game against Washington. Washington has that explosive offense with Michael Penix Jr. and all of those wide receivers. Plus, we'll find out what the running back situation is officially as we get closer to the game. Michigan has a great defense, though. So, how do you see this playing out? What does Michigan have to do to walk away with the W on Monday night?
Yeah, this is one of those things that I feel like everyone really knows, and it's that this game is going to be won in the trenches for Michigan. If they can run the ball, if they can stop the run, if they can control that passing game and you know, get ahead and stay ahead early, you know, this is a win for them. But if they let him go out and, you know, throw for 300, 400 passing yards and they get explosive plays early, it's going to be a challenge for us. So the biggest thing for us is win that game up front, so it starts with the D linemen. You know, Mason Graham and Chris Jenkins and all those guys up front, just stopping that run, getting after the passer and making him uncomfortable, because he's not really a running quarterback. He's someone that moves around the pocket well. So, you know, it's just making him uncomfortable, making him make those difficult throws, and then just having our cornerback step up when their time's called to make those plays, because they have an outstanding wide receiver core.
What would a win in this game mean for Michigan? The legacy, the Harbaugh legacy, Michigan as a whole, all of the adversity, whether self-inflicted or not, that the program went through this season.
Yeah, I mean, this is everything. Every alumni that I've talked to, every player that's ever been here, anyone that's graduated from the university, we're all just looking for that, you know, that milestone victory for the Wolverines. And for me, you know, being someone that grew up or was born in 95, I didn't really get to experience that, you know, 1997 championship with Charles Woodson. So this is really that win that I think just propels Michigan further. And we were down when I first got to school, but now I feel like we've just built those pieces up and up, and this is really our greatest opportunity. So it means everything to us as Michigan fans, as alumni. You know, just to get this win would just be huge. And, you know, just that belief in Harbaugh, belief in, you know, what he's put together. It's not been easy. It's been up and down. But, you know, now we're right there and it's so close. And you feel like there's something special. And I have a great feeling that we're going to win this game.
And I know Michigan brass has already said that they want Harbaugh back. And why wouldn't you? Because like we talked about, a brilliant football mind. And yet you keep hearing those rumors to the NFL. How would his coaching style work in the NFL as somebody who has played in the league as long as you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that you really look at is just at his brother and what a great job that he's been doing in Baltimore, you know, even winning a Super Bowl against Jim. Jim's done it before. It's not like one of those other college coaches like a Saban or, you know, one of those other guys that was having success in college and then left to go to the NFL and it didn't really work out. Like, Harbaugh's been there. He's been in the championship game. He's, you know, he's made it all the way to that point, so he knows what it takes. And he's doing it again in college. So it just speaks volume to him as a coach. And I know that guys rally behind him, and he's someone that people would want to play for.
He is Mo Hurst. I'm guessing some people call you Maurice.
Yes.
Former Michigan defensive lineman joining us here in the ESPN College Football Sprinter Van presented by Mercedes-Benz.